Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How much power can we harvest from the wind, and how should we handle the trade-offs that come from this clean and renewable energy source? Our finite supplies of oil, coal, and natural gas, and the environmental problems created when we burn them, make wind turbines a very attractive alternative, and turbines have become a common sight across Texas and the Plain States in recent years. So how efficient are modern windmills at collecting energy, and what can be done to mitigate the problems of noise, wildlife hazards, and intermittent weather patterns? Robert W. Ryder is here to talk about that. He is research professor of history at SMU, which, in the interest of full disclosure, we'd like to note is a sponsor of this program. His new book is called Windfall, Wind Energy in America Today. Bob, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Today's wind turbines are so sleek and industrial-looking that it's easy to forget that they have a really ancient history. Can you talk just briefly about how long it has been since humankind recognized that there was power in the wind?
Well, I think we have to go back about 1,000 years or so to Iran, and we started using carousel-type windmills, which would circulate like a carousel and create power to grind grain mainly, but also to pump water. But it wasn't for a long time until we have electricity coming into the play in the late 19th century. From, say, about 1870 to 1900 was kind of a revolution in terms of power production. Electricity all of a sudden kind of started taking over the world, and it's been doing more and more ever since. And so wind turbines, however, got started in 1886. A fellow in Cleveland, Charles Brush, created a huge wind turbine in his backyard. He had a 5-acre backyard, and he created his own energy for about 20 years until he could hook up to central power. In Cleveland, they didn't have any central power till about 1900. So he was a scientist, and he wanted power to do his experiments, and so he had his own power source.
And so the wind turbines we have today, are they just very modern versions of what we had as far back as the 1880s?
Well, basically, yes. I mean, they're obviously much more sophisticated. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you could think in terms of the Wright brothers in aviation and the airplanes of today and the wind turbines of Charles Brush versus the turbines of today. There's quite a difference, obviously, but basically the same.
It does seem like they have gotten much, much bigger over just the past few decades. Can you talk about the reasons for that? Is a larger turbine more efficient?
I think so. Mm-hmm. I'm not an engineer, so I always get a little reluctant to get into these questions, but the first turbines in the United States that were really prevalent were just small ranch turbines, usually, that created a little power for electric lights and maybe a few appliances in the house, and a radio particularly mm-hmm. were good for. But then they grew, and then the government started getting interested in funding a little bit in the 1970s. And then the 1980s, there was a whole kind of a revolution almost in California, in which the turbines kept getting bigger and bigger, but not comparable. They're maybe 1/15 the size of the turbines today. They're small, but yet they were starting to really create sizable energy. But the turbines have gotten bigger and bigger, and it's quite remarkable. I don't know when it's going to stop.
At some point, I guess we'll get the biggest possible blade we can have, and then we'll be done.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're getting to most of the turbines today, maybe 1.5 megawatts, as they call, but the Germans have created a 5-megawatt turbine. Hmm. It's still an experimental. I don't think they've gone into production on that. But now we're getting to 3.6 megawatts. Probably we're going to go into production.
How are decisions made, Bob, about where to put these things?
Well, first of all, you have to have the resource. You've got to have wind. certain portions of the United States, like the American South, except along the coastline, are not going to be wind energy areas. They just don't have enough wind. As you get further north, you get generally more and more wind. And so the wind resources is extremely important. Then we're going to get into land, and we've got to have quite a bit of land for a wind farm or a really electrical production area. They're no longer – that's kind of a misnomer. They're getting so big as a wind farm. You know, you think small, but these are – we're thinking big. So hundreds of acres of land are usually necessary. And then you've got to – the companies have to deal with the landowner, whether it's the federal government or the state government or private landowners, and see if they can work out an arrangement in terms of royalties and also your neighbors. You have the government to deal with, as we may want to get into. There's some people that don't want wind turbines within their view, and so you have to deal with the government and whether they can get their okay or not.
That's a really interesting question. Just the issue of what they look like on the landscape. To be honest, I think they're pretty. And when I drive, you know, through Kansas or places in Colorado or Texas for that matter, I like to see them. But some people who have lived there forever, who don't just drive through, don't want to see the landscape change.
Well, that's interesting. I'm not a psychologist, but I think it has something to do with memory. If you had lived out there all of your life and all of a sudden these huge turbines come into view, you might think of them as monstrosities. And but it is a personal thing, I think. I've talked to hundreds of people probably over the years of whether they like wind turbines or not. And it's just an individual thing. Some people love them. Some hate them. I remember I had a very good friend who's a well-known author and very creative person. She and her dad came to dinner, and we got onto wind turbines shortly, and she said, "I love them. I just love to see them out on – I mean, they're a living sculpture for her." And her dad, who was actually laid pipe for natural gas pipelines for a living, says, "I hate them," you know, and I quickly turned the subject because it looked like it was. But, you know, so there's so many different views, and people sometimes really surprise me. Some people like yourself kind of see them as sculpture, and certainly in places in the West, which is such a vast land. I spent a lot of time in Wyoming, and quite frankly, a lot of the landscape is pretty boring. And to have those wind turbines out there gives you interest and almost stimulation.
Is there any way to – there's no real way to camouflage them, right? You can't – even if you painted them a different color, it wouldn't necessarily work.
They've tried different colors, but you cannot – you can't make them invisible. They're there. And you can – the color makes a little difference, but generally they cannot be camouflaged.
And then there's also the issue of the sound that they make. And one doesn't imagine a lot of noise, but there's kind of a constant low hum essentially when they're working. Is that right?
That's right. It's kind of interesting, the differences. I've been up in, in Oklahoma or in West Texas during the day, and I can hardly hear them. I can get right close to them because there is a lot of ambient noise during the day all the time. But at night, when things quiet down, they can become very, very annoying, and they can cause sleeplessness. They can cause restlessness. They can cause nervous disorders. There's a woman, a doctor named Nina Pierpont, who has done a lot of work in this area, and she came up with a theory of wind energy syndrome, in which there are a lot of mental disorders for certain people who live close to wind turbines. And it's a phenomena that again, is individualistic. I think some people don't mind at all. I mean, we're all different in terms of noise factors. I can get extremely annoyed at a barking dog outside of my house at night, and I think a lot of people do. Whereas my wife says, "Oh, what's that?" You know. And so we are really very, very different in terms of our reception to noise or annoyance at noise, probably. But it is a big factor. I thought when I first started studying kind of wind energy that the view shed, the viewing them, was the main problem.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I've changed over now to noise factors. And companies and government and so forth may have to do something about ameliorating these factors for people, because they really do. They have caused mental disorders, I think, in some cases.
And the problem with both of these issues, with the effect on the landscape and the effect on noise in the area, is that you may say, I don't want a wind turbine on my property. I don't want to have anything to do with it. But if your next door neighbors who own the land, or the federal government or the state government says put one up, there's the question of whose rights are most important.
Yeah, that's a strong situation. Difficulty in the United States. We, believing in property rights, we believe that the landowner has the, in most cases, the full authority, once he gets government recognition or approval, to put up a wind turbine, and he makes all the royalties from the turbine. And they can amount to anywhere from, maybe from $2,000 to $12,000 per year per turbine.
Which, if you have enough of these, is an income.
Right. You don't have to worry about your cows anymore, mm-hmm. or whatever, on ranching property. But your next-door neighbor receives nothing, and we really need to change that. If you look to Europe, France particularly, they have worked out an arrangement so that property owners who do not actually own the land, they receive a portion of the royalty monies. They may still be very unhappy to have it there, but at least you're getting something in your pocketbook for putting up with the what they would say the ruination of their view shed.
Do most of the companies that build and maintain these things, do they prefer to lease the land as opposed to trying to buy up plots of land?
I think they do, mm-hmm. in most cases. I can't say for sure. But now more and more, it used to be simply wind energy companies would form to create power and then sell it to utility companies. Now more and more utility companies are actually leasing with landowners. I think probably the largest wind energy company in Texas is Florida Light and Power, which is a utility company that has now gone into the wind power business.
And I guess ultimately there are financial benefits to that kind of vertical integration.
There are. And, you may want to get into a little bit of the kind of government incentives that come about from wind energy for the companies that get into the business. And as
you've actually set us up perfectly, we'll take a quick break and then we will talk a bit about that.
Sounds good.
My guest this hour is Robert W. Ryder. He's research professor of history at SMU and author of the new book Windfall, Wind Energy in America Today. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, we invite your calls now to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Robert W. Ryder. He is research professor of history at SMU and author of the new book Windfall, Wind Energy in America Today. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. Bob, what role does the government play right now in the cultivation of the wind energy industry?
Well, quite a bit. They, as far as the federal government, they give a production tax credit, which usually amounts to about 2 cents, a little over 2 cents per kilowatt hour produced. That doesn't sound like much money, mm-hmm. but there's a lot of kilowatts produced in a wind turbine, mm-hmm. and so it does count a lot. And then there's renewable portfolio standards. These are state run, and there's 29 states, I believe, now that have renewable portfolios. And what that says essentially is that the amount of power produced in the state, a certain percent of it will be renewable. In other words, you can't have all coal mm-hmm. or whatever. In some cases, and actually Texas does quite well on that because other states may not be producing enough renewable energy. And so they have to buy that. If it's a state standard, they have to buy that renewable energy from states like Texas that are producing a lot of wind energy.
So it's like an inverted cap and trade in a way.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, yes, exactly. There are other, we should say there are other incentives. There's accelerated depreciation. That's true of almost any company or any building or any situation. But I think there are voluntary programs too. And there's a lot of every wind energy company when it comes into, say, a county in Texas will negotiate a tax abatement mm-hmm. in which they will pay sometimes no taxes practically for the privilege of coming in and creating jobs, which are very important in many of the counties in Texas.
How many jobs are there once these things are installed? I mean, obviously there are maintenance costs, but are there a lot of jobs that come into a community with wind?
Well, not really. Mm-hmm. When you are constructing the turbines, there are a lot of jobs, and that does give you a little boost. But according to the American Wind Energy Association, which puts out a lot of facts on wind energy, they say that the direct and indirect jobs supported in 2010 in Texas are between 8 and 9,000. So, there's some.
Yeah, but
not,
considering the size of the industry in Texas.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. And Texas creates more wind energy than any other state in the union these days. So, which was one of the reasons why I got into this, to writing this book. I had written one earlier on the history of wind energy. And at that time, I was living in El Paso, and Texas created no commercial wind energy whatsoever. It was all in California. 80-90% of the wind energy in the world was produced in California in the 1990s, 1980s and 90s. And now Texas is number one, and that was one. And I thought, well, I'm living in Texas now, and so I ought to do something more. And so we decided to do kind of a new book with a little more focus on Texas and what's been going on here.
Well, it seems like such an obvious choice for the state. We have a lot of empty space. Right. We have a lot of wind. How feasible is it to put these things in places where there's nothing else going on, where there's not even cattle ranching, and they really don't get in anybody's way?
Well, the primary problem is the grid. Mm-hmm. You have to get the power to the population centers, mainly Dallas-Fort Worth, San Antonio, Houston, so forth. Basically, what you have to do is you create the power in the western part of the state, mm-hmm. and you move it to the eastern part by way of the grid. So we're doing a lot of that in the state of Texas now, building and trying to get new grids. And it's not it's not easy to do that either. People don't want power lines coming over their house any more than they want a wind turbine mm-hmm. right in front of them. So it's all fairly controversial.
Is that mostly subsidized infrastructure there too?
Subsidized?
Mm-hmm.
I really don't understand too much about the grid, but yes, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, I think it is. Boone Pickens said if the government or Texas doesn't help him, I'll build my own, but he hasn't done that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Robert in Texas raising the very large issue of the effect of wind turbines on wildlife, especially birds.
Avian mortality, we call it, and it is a real problem in some areas. Some areas it's not. The primary problem has come in California in the wind energy area right east of San Francisco Bay, the Altamont Pass, it's called. And that's rolling grasslands, and there's a lot of little what you might call raptor snacks that live there, mice mm-hmm. and so forth, and these golden eagles, hawks of various sorts, find that, they seem to forget about the wind turbine mm-hmm. as they go after for a kill. I've watched buzzards there, California buzzards circle above, hundreds of them circling mm-hmm. above the wind turbines, and they don't seem to be bothered much at all. And I think they have to wait until something is dead for 2 or 3 days, and then they go down. So the raptors, that's a big problem at Altamont Pass. Other areas, not so much. Songbirds, always a problem, but the wind energy industry likes to compare the number of songbirds that are killed by a wind turbine versus the number of songbirds killed by cats throughout the United States. And it's much higher for the cats, you might say. So, but it is a problem. There are some real serious problems like cranes. We have cranes that migrate from the south to the north and vice versa. And they fly at high elevations, but they land at every night. And they have to, they come in and low and they go out low and they can be hit by. So that's been a problem. But it's a major problem. But I like to look at one of the most controversial wind energy projects has been Cape Wind out in Hyannisport. Out there, the Audubon Society took the position that they favored the wind energy project on the basis that not only human beings would be assisted or aided by more wind energy and less pollution, but the birds would be too. So there's so many trade-offs mm-hmm. and all this sort of thing that I think they're doing the best they can, I think, with trying to mitigate bird kills, but it's going to happen.
And there have been experiments using radar to detect when, say, flocks of migrating birds are coming through a particular area and turning off the wind turbines?
They have done that occasionally, I think, and they have – I don't know how effective the radar is, but it was a big issue some years ago with the California Condor. Mm-hmm. And the Condor was – they wanted to build a wind energy plant actually in L.A. County, which needs, clean air. But the bird interests simply said the California condor, which they've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to keep alive as a species, might be affected. They said, well, we'll turn off the wind turbines, but that was not enough to convince the bird interests or the condor interests.
Are the egg beater models any less hazardous to wildlife than the pinwheel models?
Well, they're so much lower, mm-hmm. And they're not near as large at the moment. But so from that point of view, I don't know for sure if they would be easier on the birds or not. I do think we should have I do think we should have choices, and mm-hmm. I do write in the book that we should have choices in the types of not only for the birds, but just for our viewing pleasure, if you mm-hmm. want to put it that way. We should have those, and they're not quite as efficient, mm-hmm. but we should have other kinds. And I might say that I think in 100 years' time, that the wind turbines that we have today may be totally obsolete. There's other companies, and as engineers that are putting together different types of turbines. The most interesting to me is the Kawani turbine company. I'm sorry.
That's all right. While you look for your notes, I'll give our phone number once again.
Okay.
And you can find that. 1-800-933-5372 is the phone number. Email address is think@kera.org.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, it's Kanani, M-A-K-N-K-A-N-I, Power, and you can find it on the Internet. And they have put together a group of really impressive engineers from MIT and other very well-known universities, and they're trying to build, and they've been fairly successful in building a wind kite, almost, which would go up, which would work in elevations of 1,000 to 2,000 feet high, where the wind is much stronger than down at a couple hundred meters, and they would fly all day up there at that elevation, just circling around, creating wind energy. And they have, it's, I think, a long ways to go, but I think that either they or some of the other very innovative companies will eventually create wind turbines that are much different than what we have today. And so I think when we come back 100 years from now, you know, it would be like the airplane, the Wright brothers versus our present-day jets.
Almost unrecognizable.
Yeah, almost unrecognizable.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones now to Paul in Fort Worth. Hi, Paul.
Yeah, hi. I attended a wind energy conference in Dallas about a year ago, and one of the things that became very apparent was that the Chinese and Koreans were heavily investing and, in fact, supplying a lot of the wind energy generation equipment, namely the generators and such. And I wonder why is this just another lost industry like the solar industry also? The only thing I'm aware of in this area, in fact, is like I think the large fiberglass blades for some of the Texas turbines are made up near, I think, Denton. But I just wonder why the U.S. has not really dominated that.
Well, the Chinese have greatly increased their wind power. We now are at about 43 megawatts of power in the United States capability, and the Chinese are a little bit above that, I think 44, 45. So they have surpassed us, as I understand it. They have they don't have to worry too much about private industry. If they want to build it, they'll build it. And they're building a lot of coal plants also, as we know. But they're heavily into wind energy. And they are exporting their wind turbines to the United States. But I don't think that we have lost out altogether. General Electric is creating hundreds and hundreds, probably thousands of 1.5 megawatt turbines, and I think they're going to get larger. But it is a, whether we like it or not, a global market. Cape Wind, which is going to be a very big project, is going to, I understand, a few years ago that they were going to use General Electric turbines, a new one at 3.6 megawatts. Now I understand they're going to buy Siemens, which is a German company, and they're going to – so I don't know what you can say, but we certainly have not lost out. And there's a lot of companies in Texas that are doing small things. I know there's a company called DeWind, I think, which is creating a lot of turbines. And we have quite a few turbine companies, but we're late in the game, certainly. Vestas, a Danish company, is probably the best-known company, and they have their turbines all over the United States.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. And that is where we hear from Greg. Greg writes, I was in Lubbock last year, and there are fields of these large wind turbines which were not turning, though the wind was blowing. I asked about them, and they told me they could only transmit so much energy as they had no way to store what they were producing. I find it hard to believe we can't store energy. What sort of progress have we made toward that?
I wish we had an engineer probably to answer that question, but we do have a capacity problem, mm-hmm. particularly with the grid. Wind energy, as you might suspect, well, any energy, electrical energy, we cannot store large amounts of it. We can put it in a battery in our car, but when you get into large amounts of wind electric, we have to use it or lose it.
Mm-hmm.
And if we, if the grid is already stacked up with coal-generated electricity, then they simply cannot put too much more into it. Now, I talked to a grid operator at ERCOT, which is where we create almost that runs the whole grid system from mm-hmm. all of Texas. And he said that we're doing better. He said we are learning to – the word he used rather continually was balance.
The balancing act, sure.
Balance. And for many engineers, they did not like that. We want to be in control. You know, we want to be able to turn on the power plant, whether it be natural gas, whether it be coal, whether we're going to increase the water, hydropower coming out of the dam. We want to be in control of it. Unfortunately, nature is control of the wind, and we're doing better, though. And I would say that we're getting much better at predicting wind on an hourly basis so that if you can predict the wind, then you can start the not produce as much coal power, you know.
When you don't need it.
And when you don't need it. Right?
Robert W. Ryder is my guest. His new book is called Windfall, Wind Energy in America Today. We'll take more of your calls in a moment. The number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is research professor of history at SMU, Robert W. Ryder. His new book is called Windfall, Wind Energy in America Today. If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org or call in to 1-800-933-5372. We have an email here from Harold in McKinney who says, gas wells and oil rigs are unsightly. Mountaintop removal and slag heaps affect the view. Water runoff carries waste into waterways. Why are all these gas and coal, oil, ill effects ignored and wind turbines subject to wide criticism? Do you feel like it's uneven?
No, I don't think so. It's a matter, I think, of the fact that the wind blades or the turbines move. I think that makes a big difference. Mm-hmm. If something is stationary, I think it is not as noticeable, and it may not be as offensive. The wind turbines, when you're out in the midst of wind turbines, I mean, it is surreal. And you may like it, but most people would not want to live near wind turbines because they're moving all the time. At times when the sun is correct, you're going to get flashes in your house.
You're living in a
strobe light.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And so that sort of things do not exist with oil rigs. And of course, they are so large today that that you have to get close to one and to realize the immensity of them. Some of them are, the blades are reaching to 500 feet in the air.
Hmm. You know. So people want them sometimes, but not in their own backyards.
That's right. And there's a couple of chapters in the book on that with a number of examples of people that have been very frustrated and because of the sight, but the noise as well. And I understand now, you know, I'm not living near a natural gas well either, but I guess they can be pretty noisy as well, at least until they get going.
Do you imagine we'll start to see more of these smaller turbines within urban settings?
I would like to see so. You know, I think myself, and one of the reasons that I wrote the first book was the effort or the fight between centralized power and decentralized power. Centralized power obviously won. Mm-hmm. But today we're moving a little more toward decentralized power. And wind energy is perfect, you know, if you're living out in the countryside and you want to be independent, and a lot of us want to be independent mm-hmm. of government.
Off the grid, as it were.
Off the grid, you can get a wind turbine. And so I think that we're going to see more and more people get off the grid. Especially as energy, as I think it will. I think our electrical energy has got to go up in price. Mm-hmm. Hate to say that, but...
Which is good for the wind industry, ultimately.
It's good for the wind industry, but it's good for the environment, too. We haven't talked at all about consumption, mm-hmm. but we obviously consume far too much electricity in the United States, far more than we have to.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phones to Jeremy in Dallas. Hey, Jeremy.
Hey, Chris. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Earlier, you were talking, our guest was talking about the concerns of, you know, birds flying into the turbines and, you know, and I guess in certain farms where that could be a big problem. I'm just curious if anybody has ever thought, and this may be more of an engineering type of question again, but of, you know, putting some sort of like protective mesh or screening around them, you know, similar to our, you know, common box fans that we have in the house. Or would that just be a kind of an engineering impossibility?
We need an engineer to answer that question. I think for one thing, you would probably decrease the power of the wind if you put a screen around there. But in other words, a fan, you're blowing air out through the screen. Here you're trying to get wind to come into the screen. I'm not an engineer, but I'm not sure that it would work or not.
Mm-hmm. Do we know anything about the impact on wildlife that are on the ground of, say, the shifting light patterns and the noise? Is it scaring away animals that would normally live there?
In some cases, it has been a real issue. I spend time in Wyoming, and the sage grouse has been a major factor in terms of wind energy. What happens is that the sage grouse stays very close to the ground, usually doesn't probably fly much more than 10 feet in the air, but they're very fearful of anything that's above them because that's where the hawks hang out particularly. Mm-hmm. And I have pointed out to a friend, I said, well, the new tubulars, there's no place for a hawk to perch up there and wait mm-hmm. for a... And his response, and it's a very true one, that the sage grouse don't know that.
Yeah.
So sage grouse, I don't know, a lot of... and the photo on the cover of this book shows two elk mm-hmm. Who do not seem to be disturbed whatsoever. Most wildlife do not seem to be disturbed, large... fauna, are just not disturbed too much, but we haven't been able to talk to them too much. But they don't desert an area when wind turbines are put up.
And in fact, there are ranchers who continue to ranch and some farmers who continue to farm just right around the base of those things.
Oh, absolutely. Right. Particularly in Europe, they have the farm crops right up to the turbines.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to George in Plano. Hello, George.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a follow-up question, something that was asked earlier, regarding the storage of energy power from wind turbines.
Uh-huh.
What I was wondering is, I've read about several different technologies that are able to do this. most basic one is just pumping water uphill during off-peak hours and then using traditional water turbines to recover that energy.
Right.
And I know a lot of those tend to be very lossy, that they lose a lot of that power. My question was whether your guest feels that there's regulatory and technological reasons for keeping those storage uses being put into place, or whether it's more of an issue of funding.
So a regulatory issue or a funding issue, do you think?
I think it's a funding issue, to my knowledge. There are about, I think there's something like 80 or so the reservoir systems where they release the water during peak hours and then pump it back up during off-peak hours. But there's not enough to make much difference there. They're not doing it on a large scale. But I kind of missed out. He was breaking up a little bit.
I think he was asking about the reasons why we're not using more of these water systems and what was the holdup with that. And I think you answered that. So.
Yeah, I think the availability. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is a technical problem. You have to have two reservoirs and whether it be makes sense economically at all would be certainly an issue.
I'm sure this varies because the size varies and the generation capacity varies, but what's the initial capital outlay to put a wind turbine on a piece of land that's never had one before?
Mm-hmm. Well, the turbines usually, I think, probably $2 to $3 million per turbine these days, like the General Electric 1.5. And then, of course, there's all the other stuff, you know, this preparation. These turbines have a very large cement structure underground. They really do.
So they don't tip over and...
That's right. And so there's a cost there of putting up the turbines. There's royalties to the landowner. There's all the usual costs, insurance policies of various sorts, I'm sure. So, you know, I can't say for sure, but probably it's going to cost at least $3 million per kilowatt hour, per megawatt.
Mm-hmm.
And most of these turbines are more like 1.5 megawatts. But I think you need a company person to come in and probably give you a better idea.
Yeah, I guess at the end of the day, there is a certain number of years before an investor can expect to recoup his or her investment.
Yeah, I think, of course, they have accelerated depreciation, which is important to them. And that accelerated depreciation, even though I think a wind turbine should last at least 20 years, accelerated depreciation is 5 years, I think. But the turbine's life of a turbine has generally been considered to be 20 years. Now, it may be going up. I think the turbines, compared to the ones that were built in the 1980s, which really didn't work, very many of them, for long, the turbines of today are much, much, much better and much more efficient.
What else do we need to consider from a public policy standpoint to get this industry, one would argue that it is off the ground now, but to really get it to where it can grow independently? What else do we need?
Well, first of all, I think we're going to have to pay more for electricity, no matter how we produce it. It's just got to go up. And on the other hand...
That is not politically feasible, as I'm sure you're aware.
I know it's not. But... if we don't do that, then we're going to have to stop our consumption of it. So, you know, I've been around for quite a few years, and we have recognized this problem of electricity and our consumption of it, but we haven't done anything about it. You know, we're still consuming. And way back, Jimmy Carter said, hey, you've got to wear two sweaters at night and turn down the heat to 68 degrees. We said, oh, no way. We're going to – and so that didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
So what are we going to do? I don't know exactly a solution except that the cost is going to go up. And I think wind energy is going to make a much greater contribution. It's at about probably something over 3% of our energy in the United States is renewable, and almost all of it is wind. And the company and the government, and the government would like to see by the year 2030 that we have 20% wind energy in the United States. That's going to be a job, and it's going to be a tremendous commitment, you know, comparable to, you know, building a national highway system in terms of not only the turbines but the infrastructure, the grid to pull that off. But it in many ways, it does make sense.
Mm-hmm. It makes sense. I mean, based on what you have studied, Bob, is it a feasible goal, 20% by 2030?
Well, if you could take the politics out of it, it might be.
Now we're doing the impossible.
Yeah, right. They've just come out a report. It's actually says 20% wind energy by 2030, and they believe the federal government and the industry that it is possible. So possible, feasible, you can define those words as you wish, but it would be possible, yeah. We can do it. We can't go much more than 20% of a variable wind energies or energy source like wind, which doesn't create wind or power all the time.
If we go very quickly here, we have time to take one more call, and that's from Clayton in Lone Willow. Hi, Clayton.
Hi, Chris. This is Clayton, and I have, on the ground, been doing cogeneration of all types for about 25 years. And the author is very right on with many of the points. The bigger point is that as I try to add electricity to the grid, that nobody in the grid side is ready for that.
We don't have too much time, so let's get a response to that statement. Thank you so much, Clayton.
Well, we have a law called PURPA law, which forces a utility company to take power in that you create or co-generate, mm-hmm. essentially. So you should be able to put your power into a utility company, and you should be able to – I don't know why, but for many years, utility companies were very resistant. They didn't want –
they didn't want to pay you.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And they didn't want to pay, and they didn't want to be bothered with this little stuff called wind turbines, you know. And he sounds like he has a fairly small, probably, you know, 100 kilowatt or less power. And they didn't want to be bothered with that. But the federal government – and this goes back to 1978 – forced them under the PURPA Act. And that's created wind energy business in many ways.
Robert W. Ryder is research professor of history at SMU. His new book is called Windfall, Wind Energy in America Today. Bob, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Christine McConnell produces the podcast, and our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.